Well, it's 7:15, it's a little after 7:15, so let's go ahead. Wendy's celebrating a birthday with her daughter tonight, but she said, "I'm supposed to announce that this is being recorded," which you've probably heard if you've been in any other sessions this week, so that's that announcement.
Does that always mean we're not to say any naughty things?
I don't think that, well, it's good, that's not gonna hold you back, Lynn, I don't think. What a wonderful Vespers to follow. That was
over the top.
Yeah, that was a great lead in to the what we're doing today, so tonight. And the Mari Halkin song was from 2009, but I hadn't discovered it yet. So that one will go back to St. Andrew, and we'll use that at some point. We do various times during the year. We use music creation themes, and we have a sanctuary of the firs, we call it. It's literally a sanctuary out in some firs, and we try to worship there at least a couple of times during the summer. And we've even done baptisms out there, and so that's a special time. For a song like this would just be so fitting in a place like that sanctuary of the firs. So outlines here, we'll make sure everybody's got and then if by chance you're interested in any of the other outlines, and I do have a pre-publication flyer that you can pick up into for the book that's coming out. And I did get, even here at Holden, it's a little slow on the internet, but today the final pages came, so I'm prepared to. So the next step then is to index it, and then it'll come out. So that it's to
that's very exciting.
Thank you. Wanted to lift up from the last time, introduce the word contuition. And this comes from Bonaventure. If you go back far enough, Bonaventure, St. Francis is an example of one who really understood contuition. But the basic idea is to see things as God sees them. And one of the parts of contuition then is to really look at something in a careful way and observe it, and to look at it long enough until you finally see it as God sees it. And I talked about the notion of delight, when God looks at all that God has created and it was very good, or the Hebrew really, you could have translated that exceedingly good. And so I thought, well, that's really delight is what we're talking about, how God delights in all that God has created. So just to keep that notion in mind, even as we go through what we'll be working on today. One of the concerns I've had as I work through this project and had it for a number of years is there's a real danger when things are not going well in the world, and you start looking at these things closely, whether it's climate change or you see the kind of conflict and violence that we're witnessing in the world. It can be difficult not to become cynical, I had a conversation a number of years ago with my oldest son, who is, he can cut through and analyze, he cuts through pretense better than just about anybody I know, whether it's on the right, the left, or the middle, or wherever he might find it. But I was concerned, at one point I did talk to him, I was concerned to have somebody in his mid-20s becoming, really in a sense, cynical about things. And good news is I think he's moved from there, and he's still very good at cutting through pretense, but he also has this sense of, I think it's a more hopeful sense, and just by the things, he's now working at a St. Francis Montessori Earth School as a guide for 7th and 8th graders, and so that is, I think he's really enjoying it for one thing, but it's great to see him, you know, investing himself in something like that. And I think it's really important that we as people of faith do not give in to cynicism, that we do not give in to cynicism. And I really view a place like Holden Village as a place that amidst all the other things that a place like Holden Village does, it helps people of faith, and maybe even people that are struggling with faith or whatever, but some sense of hope in the midst of everything else that's going on in our world. And so if you notice the verse I picked out for this particular presentation tonight, "For surely I know the plans that I have for you," it's at the top of the page there, "plans for your welfare and word there is shalom in Hebrew, and not for harm, to give you a future with hope. And Jeremiah's speaking to people, you know, he's the fall of Jerusalem, it's that time period that's coming, and Jeremiah is warning the people, Judah there, of what's coming, and to say, to give you a future with hope. Even in the midst of that situation, Jeremiah lifts up that hope, word of hope. Priming the pump question, we'll start with that. What ecological log do we need to take out of our eyes? So what, just as you are looking at things, what's going on, what ecological log is there that you're sensing a need to take out? I mean, this is the time to look at ourselves and say, in what sense are we, maybe individually, or your sense of as a community, church, country, world, what ecological log do we need to take out of our eyes? And then I'll also, if that one doesn't get you going, what gives you the hope, what gives you some sense of hope in the midst as we face the ecological crisis that's before us? So either something you're hopeful about, ecological log, or maybe a word about both. Do that two or three to a group, and you can turn and discuss that with each other. I'll give you, you know, 5, 6, 7 minutes to do that.
Is there any hope? But then, technology will save us all, and just, you know. I think it makes me feel better, is the whole idea that they take it down. So at least you're moved, you know, you may not get here, you know, that neighbor that takes a shower without a kid, so they can recycle the water. You might not be there, but you're not running, you know, that's. That gives me some, you know, okay, what can I do?
Give you another minute or two. Lord be with you.
It's a storm to your mom. Anyway, that's mother. Sorry, mom. You still?
All right, I'm going to go ahead. And I say it every time. I hate to interrupt people when they're talking, but it's priming the pump. And with the pump, you just prime it enough to get water flowing. Back, remember a pump we had back at camp in Wisconsin called Outpost, where I spent a lot of time and have good memories of that from when I was a child. So in terms of things for make for peace, and the biblical term, the Hebrew term is shalom, and in which we translate peace, and peace, when we tend to use it, often simply means for us the absence of violence, and that's certainly part of peace. But the biblical notion of shalom or peace is a much fuller concept, and I offer here a holistic definition. And this is important because shalom is really the key vision. Biblically, Walter Brueggemann lifts this up, but it's the key vision of creation's history. This is the vision that we're offered in the biblical account. So we're talking about well-being of the whole person, mind, body, heart, and spirit. When we talk about shalom, we're talking about well-being in our relationships to God, humans, and the creation, but also earth then, the whole earth community. Well-being in families, neighborhoods, congregations, communities, watersheds, and nations. Now, when I've talked about this in a place like Beaverton or some other places where I've talked about it, the notion of a watershed is a little more striking. Here at Holden, it's kind of obvious that the watershed is a primary geographic, what you would talk about geographically, part of a watershed here. So in some sense, it's easier to get a handle on that than it would be in a place like Beaverton, where we, you know, the boundaries that we pay attention to would be a county line or state line, all these geographic lines. But I think it's important for us then to learn to think in terms of watersheds, and I think that that will be more and more important for us as we go forward. And watersheds, but along with that, then ecosystems and so on. Those are the primary realities of our lives. Isaiah offers a beautiful vision of the peaceable kingdom. In Isaiah 11, the wolf lying down with the lamb, and so on. It is a beautiful vision, but it, in a sense, if you just stick with that vision, there's something you'd say, well, wait a minute, though. You know, we have to eat in order to live. And in order to live, life has to be sacrificed so that other life may live. That's just a basic reality in our lives. And the key question then, or the key distinction that I try to draw here, is necessary sacrifice versus what we might call abusive, gratuitous violence. And so I try to draw that distinction in the book and have a discussion of that. What's the difference between abusive, gratuitous type violence and then what we call necessary sacrifice? And certainly we're going to talk about all God's creatures. I mean, whether we're vegetarians or vegans or not, there are creatures that are going to just kill other creatures and in order to survive, and that's part of the reality. And I think if we ignore that, then our discussion of the creation and harmony and all of that can seem a little bit detached from the realities of the actual lives that we live.
Can I offer an example of what I've learned from Alaska Natives and their history? They have this sense of when they go hunting for whale or otter or so forth, that they wait, you know, and then this animal offers himself.
Yeah.
And they give thanks to the animal, to creation, that you have offered yourself for my sake and for my family and so forth. And then in their history, though, then came the Russians, for example, who abused the natives and then also abused the plant. And what did they want? They wanted skin after skin after skin after skin to market.
Yeah.
You know, and they were never satisfied, and they were, of course, depleting their resources and everything and being abusive to the natives. But it's a very different perspective.
I draw a distinction between what leads to the flourishing of life, the fullness of life, and what leads to a diminishing of life. And I think your example is very much gets at the kind of distinction I'm trying to get at here. It's striking that in Colossians chapter 1, verse 20, that the reconciliation of all things and the establishment of shalom requires a major sacrifice. I'll just read that verse. And through him, that is through Christ, God was pleased to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, by making peace, shalom, through the blood of his cross. And so very clearly that sacrifice then is essential to the reconciliation of all things in this letter of Paul to the Colossians. So let's say it right now. I think an important question finally for each one of us is, you know, what's the how am I going to, what's the sacrifice I'm being called to make finally? Because we are going to be sacrificed for other life in some way. And so it's really what the nature of that sacrifice will be. At the very, even if we live a long life, finally you go back to the earth and there's you go back to the soil in that sense. And now it's even more striking. A guy named Benjamin Stewart, started worship at Lutheran School of Theology in Chicago. Project he's working right on now is Green Burial, and really he's doing, I think he's been doing some a sabbatical work on that, so it'll be very interesting to see what comes out of that. But the whole notion of Green Burial, we will be a sacrifice. The question is, what will be the nature of that sacrifice? It's not something we're going to avoid. And so I think it is an important question for us to consider. And I'm even wondering if we really get this, we can be, I wonder if it'll free us up to take a few more risks. If we really understand that sacrifice is just part of who we are as human beings, does that free us to maybe take some risks that we might not have taken otherwise?
You know, you were talking about just being at home and the awareness of being in the watershed. So this year, 7 fawns sacrificed themselves to the mama bears this year. I mean, and so, when, of course, when you hear another fawn go in the village, and they don't go quietly,
yeah,
it reminds you of the food chain, which, yeah, I don't like the food chain, I can tell you that. But yeah, but the fact of the matter is the bears have had cubs, and they usually don't like fawns particularly, but there wasn't enough food in the forest.
So that's,
you know, and it actually, you know, I try to remind myself every time I hear of that balance. But that is a strange blessing on the boundary, where we live, where even those things are brought to light.
If there was room, you could come back in 2 weeks for and hear Ben Stewart.
Oh, is that right? He's coming?
Well, that takes you a little up, about a week and a half.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Yeah, I'm glad to hear he's coming. Well, that's the place. Has he been here before?
He was village master at one time.
Oh, how did I not know that? Well, obviously it had an influence on him. Mm-hmm. In a very positive way.
Yeah, I think you can say that.
Yeah. Then I want to talk just briefly about this notion of rapture in reverse. This is something that Barbara Rossing likes to talk about. She wrote a book called The Rapture Exposed. So if you're interested in hearing her understanding or interpretation of Revelation, I recommend that book, The Rapture Exposed. She even got interviewed on some national television talk shows.
60 Minutes.
Yeah, 60 Minutes. And so that's obviously struck a chord. But I want to read a passage from them, and I've attached that for you. So if you look on the second page where it says select passage from chapter 4, and you can see what I do with that in the book. So this comes from chapter 4. Follow along as I read. In Revelation 21, 1 through 4, John prophesies, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'See, the home of God is among mortals. He will dwell with them, they will be his people, and God himself will be with them, and he will wipe away every tear from their eyes. Death will be no more, mourning and crying and pain will be no more. For the first things have passed away. The first heaven and first earth pass away, they die, but they are resurrected in a new creation. Salvation is not about leaving earth behind and going to heaven to be with God. A select group of human beings are not raptured to heaven as we see depicted in the Left Behind series. If there is any rapture here, it is God who is raptured to earth. In Revelation, John envisions that God's presence on earth will bring the fullness of salvation. There will be no more weeping, suffering, and death. All things will be made new. Revelation 22:5 affirms that God, the author of the Tree of Life, will provide for the healing of the nations. Salvation is a healing process. It entails the healing of mind, body, heart, and soul, the healing of relationships between God, human beings, and all creatures, the healing of the community and the nation, the healing of watersheds, ecosystems, and the whole earth community. Salvation is not about getting to heaven. It is about healing, leading to shalom. It is not about leaving anything behind, but about moving all things toward shalom. God initiates the process of salvation, and we are invited to participate in it. We do not have to be anxious about getting to heaven or about our individual salvation. If we are to be anxious about anything, it would be to focus on recognizing what God is doing with and on earth so that we can participate in it." And then the resurrection, Jesus affirms that God cares for us and for the whole earth community. Our Christian hope in the resurrection does not offer us an ultimate escape route out of this life's past and difficulties into eternity. Instead, our hope in the resurrection sends us back into the world to immerse ourselves in caring for God, human beings, and earth. Those whose primary religious concern is their individual salvation have less incentive to care for the well-being of other human beings, let alone for the well-being of earth. Given that God has reconciled all things in Christ, human beings participate with other creatures in a single community in Christ. Jesus Christ for us today is the one who seeks shalom for this community. Seeking shalom with the earth community, therefore, is not just an option for followers of Jesus. It is intended to be a way of life. So I did talk briefly in that text too about following Jesus then and making peace. I like seeking shalom as a way of life for us. With Jesus Christ for us today, this was Bonhoeffer's central question that he identified in his letters and papers from prison. So picking up on that, if we ask who is Jesus Christ for us today, then we need to look at what's happening today and certainly part of that then is what I'm suggesting, a central part of what who Jesus Christ is for us today, is one who is helping us seek shalom in our time. There's a challenge, and every age has its challenge, and that's why Bonhoeffer said we have to ask again and again, who is Jesus Christ for us today? Also, notice that this extends the scope of the least of these. Matthew 25, 31 through 46, that passage, as much as you've done unto the least of these, you've done it unto me. This vision of shalom really extends that broadly to include all of God's creatures. And then if you think of the parable of the Good Samaritan, and I developed this a little more in the book, but there's a sense in which to ignore what's going on in terms of the ecological crisis and human beings and other creatures who are suffering, to do that is to pass by on the other side. So I find that parable of the Good Samaritan very helpful. Also, too, because the initial part of that parable is a discussion of the two greatest commandments, as I mentioned the other day, and I think maybe in our time, just given what's going on, we need to talk about a third great commandment, which is you shall love creation, and then to lift up the core values, love of God, love of neighbor, which are the two classic core values in our Judeo-Christian tradition. But to talk about love of creation, and I think we also in our time, just because of the nature, we tend to focus on self. Well, I think focusing on self in a full sense, if you really focus on ourselves in the fullest sense and recognize our interconnections, love of self will also lead us in the direction that we need to go. Then I lift up the notion that there's no salvation apart from earth, and that was actually the title of the lecture I gave, the Knudsen lecture I gave, that then led to the book that I've been working on. But we're really dealing with a paradigm shift from a focus on God and humanity to a focus on God, humanity, and creation. And I believe that one of the sad consequences of this, the old paradigm, was the loss of a sense of earth as our home. Comes in a sense just was not central to, if you're focused on your individual salvation, as I said in the first session, you know, as a teenage boy thinking, do I believe in Jesus enough to get to heaven? If that's your focus, individual salvation, well then you're not going to be all that focused on earth, and I do believe we've lost, to a large extent, our culture has lost the sense of earth as our home. It's, you know, it's kind of a place where we can use it for what we want more than a sense of a home that we care for and love. I go through a number of different theologians who are, I think, moving us toward a new paradigm of salvation. I thought for our purposes, just to list some of the distinctive characteristics of this new paradigm of salvation. It's universal, so it includes everything that's created and reconciled by God. It's ecological, so it's attentive to the ecosystems in which we live. It's communal. We're talking about the community of God, human beings, and all God's creatures. It's holistic. It's a healing process leading to shalom. It's this-worldly. Think of even John 3:16, for God so loved the cosmos, for God so loved this world. But the focus is on this world. Certainly Bonhoeffer talked about this-worldliness, but also people like Ivan Gabara, Sally McFay and others really have this very much this worldly focus and understanding of salvation. It's radical in the sense it gets back to the roots of who God created and reconciled us to be. And so we really need to deal with two books. Scripture, obviously, is a central point in Christian tradition, and Lutheran tradition. So that's an important book. But also the book of creation, and I noticed in our worship tonight that came out, the creation as a book. That was very much part of that service. And I think we were almost speaking in tongues there, too, several times. When we had all those different names going off, and I assume that was part of the deal, just the fullness of the plant life and the animal life and all the variety of people even are here holding. I assume that was part of why it was done in that way. And then finally, it's relational, and with a sense of connectedness with other creatures in creation. And I think I mentioned the other day, really, I think we need a relational understanding of the self. So tendency has been in our culture, Western culture, is to think, I think, therefore I am. So a real focus on the mind is defining who we are as people. But I like to say we're in relationship with God, human beings. Well, let's go ahead then. We'll do the best we can. Last point under no salvation apart from earth then is this notion we have about give us this day our daily bread. We pray in the Lord's Prayer, but I think we also need to talk about daily beauty. Interesting, again, in a place like this, yeah, I think one of the reasons Holden has such an impact on people is you have, you obviously get fed here, and whether it's the healthy diet or this one where you can be healthy, or you can also eat so much that it's not healthy here, the way that it's being served now. But the daily bread is there in that sense, but you can't even walk here outside, if it's not raining, without seeing mountains and beauty. It's just so much a part of the place. So I think there's a health to that. In fact, there's been studies done that even having the smallest patch of green or plants or whatever it is has a positive impact on people. And even places like Chicago, there's a movement to try to get some little patch of green or whatever it might be in places so that people are exposed to that. In terms of making peace with the earth and the relationship to nature, I'm not going to go through all these in detail, but there's James Gustafson has identified 5 different possible relationships between human beings and nature. Despotism is basically where we do whatever we want with nature and just do whatever we want with it. It's a very arbitrary relationship to nature. Dominion is one where we use it for human benefit, is the way that he describes that one. Human beings have dominion over the earth, but the tendency is to think predominantly about human beings, and there's a sense that it can go the angle of domination, as I talked about the other day. Stewardship, I think, has kind of been a real strong part of our tradition, in the Lutheran tradition, the whole notion of stewardship, and using the gifts that God gives us in a good way. Although that still often tends to focus still on human benefit, I think, to a large extent, and how nature, then we want to take care of nature, but then it serves still the human benefit. Subordination is, it's almost as if we're subordinate to life. The whole notion of reverence for life. So it's almost as if we're at the service of all of life. And that could even be taken to the extreme, but then we don't take seriously human beings as part of everything. So I love the notion, Albert Schweitzer, reverence for life. I think that's, but I tend to go toward respect for life rather than reverence for life. Reverence almost seems like another kind of a level that I think respect maybe captures more of what we want. And then the notion of participation is the idea that we participate in all of the relationships and all of creation as human beings. And Augustine himself advocates for that understanding of that relationship, and I found that one very helpful.
I was wondering if, it's not his word, but if that was kind of fit with Mark Buber's take on this I-thou relationship even with creation, with a tree and so forth.
Yeah, he doesn't talk a lot about that in particular, so I don't remember.
You mean Gustafson doesn't?
Gustafson doesn't, yeah. So,
but it's definitely a relational thing.
Yeah, it's very much a relational understanding.
We're connected. We don't stand apart and just use it.
And then from a theological standpoint, then we seek to participate in what God is up to also in creation. In terms of the task of church and of human beings, the followers of Jesus as part of the church, we have twofold task. Terrific. Two things: to participate in the ministry of reconciliation, then also in the pursuit of ecological justice. I don't have time to go into all the details of that, but one way James Martin Tram, who's taught here, and Bob Steiger's talked about 4 key concepts in ecological justice: sustainability, sufficiency, providing enough, participation they lift up, and then also the notion of solidarity. And one of the difficulties for creatures is obviously when it comes to that they can be voiceless in the process of deciding, you know, in terms of their well-being. And so in that sense, it puts creatures at a disadvantage if human beings are going to make all the decisions for them, so to speak. But so it's important to take into account, again, all of God's creatures that we seek ecological justice. Going on then to second page and the whole notion of conversion to earth. Struck by Psalm 51:1, have mercy on me, O God, according to your steadfast love, according to your abundant mercy, blot out my transgressions. But there is a sense in which being honest about who we are and where we have fallen short is an important part of our, and I would say of our journey as people of faith, and certainly part of our journey in terms of coming home to earth. Ecological enlightenment is not enough to
define what you mean by conversion to earth.
It's actually what I'm going to do.
Okay.
All right. So that's where we're headed. So if I don't answer it, ask the question again.
All right.
So ecological enlightenment is not enough to fulfill this vision of shalom. Thich Nhat Hanh has said the American dream is an unsustainable way of life. There's a need for a major ecological conversion. Enlightenment's not enough. We need a conversion of hearts. And I'm not the only one, but a guy named Dieter Hessel and a number of others have talked about the need for an ecological reformation of the church. It becomes important to name our ecological sin. So if we're going to deal with this, what's going on here? Where are we falling short? The root of the problem is human selfishness and sin. Pope Bartholomew, the Green Patriarch, is very articulate on that particular. Just says this is the root of the problem. It's human selfishness and sin. He doesn't apologize at all for talking about sin. He said we need to do that. We need to take the ecological log out of our own eyes. And then one of my favorite quotations comes from David James Duncan. Comes a footnote there. Comes from Prayer for the Second Coming of the Salmon. It's an essay in My Story as Told by Water. Duncan is from the Northwest. He's been living in Montana most recently. But he says, no person, no family, no country, and no civilization has remained viable for long without engaging in corrective acts of self-criticism, self-sacrifice, and restoration. So it's one of Bonhoeffer's concerns was about the silence of the church and in the face of what was going on in Nazi Germany. And so there's a sense in which it'd be talks about as appalling for the church to be silent in the face of sin and evil. And there's a sense in which it would also be appalling for the church to be silent in our time. Let me read then, I included a brief passage from chapter 5, and that will pick up on this point. The church, therefore, needs to be willing to name its own ecological sin. Unless we do so, our proclamation on care for earth will lack integrity and will come across as hypocritical. But there is a second part to Matthew 7:5. Taking the log out of our own eye will allow us to see clearly to take the speck out of your neighbor's eye. In the case of ecological sin, it is as if we all have logs in our eyes. In Nazi Germany, Bonhoeffer was appalled by the virtual silence of the church on the Jewish question. Atrocious, destructive Nazi policies went unchecked. And the Church in the Jewish Question, published in April 1933, shortly after Hitler came to power, he identified three possible ways for the church to act against the state when the state's not fulfilling its responsibilities. One, to question whether the state is fulfilling its legitimate responsibilities, that is, to name the sin and to do that publicly. Two, to aid the victims of the actions of the state. And then, in that case, even like the Jews, pastors, there were pastors with any Jewish descent, many were no longer allowed to be pastors. So this is something that you have to aid the victims, even financially, in that case. And then we could think of other situations where the church gets involved in aiding the victims of the action of the state, or the lack of action of the state, it also could be. And three, to engage in direct political action may be necessary to seize the wheel itself. And the third way is necessary, especially when the state ignores the church's naming of the state's failure to fulfill its proper responsibility. With our Earth home under assault, it would be appalling for the church to be silent on the ecological question. The fear of being considered hypocritical can stifle the church's willingness to speak up, but when it appears we are heading over an ecological cliff, the church needs to join the chorus of those yelling stop. It is not just government leaders who need to be called to account. Corporations are often some of the worst perpetrators of ecological degradation. Churches need to listen when other environmentally minded people from within and without the church call them, that is the churches, to account. In naming the reality of ecological sin and in our eagerness to move toward shalom, Santmeyer warns us that just as we ought not minimize the evils of Hiroshima and Dresden, of Dhaka and Buchenwald, of apartheid and killing fields, we ought not minimize the presence of evil and the groaning and travail of the whole creation. Radical evil is an unavoidable mystery in life. The shadow of the cross, observes Santmeyer, falls upon the entire cosmos, not just on us human beings. Santmeyer's warning is a reminder of the presence of radical evil in all of life, including the ecological crisis. The cost of resisting radical evil can be heavy, as Bonhoeffer and all resisted the Nazis discovered. Resisting radical evil is not for the faint of heart. Those in power who benefit most from our established way of life will not give up their power and privileges easily. And if you follow it all, you know, reports about Exxon knowing decades ago, literally, about what was going on and engaging in a deliberate strategy to try to move people away from thinking climate change was a serious issue. It's not easy to give up your privileges and power. It's not likely, for example, that major oil companies will lead the effort to move us beyond fossil fuels, although I still maintain hope that they will. If they're energy companies, they could. There may be a way for them if they, I can't tell them how to do their job per se, I don't know all the details of that, but they could use their financial resources to help us move toward more renewable energy sources. We ourselves will not be eager to give up our way of life. In the face of the radical ecological evil, a silent church could be viewed as a timid church, a church that does not care.
Can I have a question?
Yeah.
Did you visualize in the next major congress of the Lutheran Church there would be a statement about this issue?
That's a great question, because the Oregon Synod actually sent a memorial. We memorialized the church-wide assembly on the issue of divesting from fossil fuels.
Yeah, but that's not the issue. Well, that's a piece of the issue. Yeah.
Well, that's not what I'm...
Something bigger than that.
They're not likely. Not likely because...
Because what?
Because it'll come through a memorial like this. And so if the memorial's not big enough, then that's what the church-wide assembly is going to focus on. Now, having said that, it does at some point... the leadership of the ELCA could step up and do something more aggressive, but I don't visualize it happening this August. But it starts what? Shortly, right? The National Assembly starts in August.
Well, I don't remember the wording, but Minnesota also memorialized and sent a big ecological call. But it isn't just to divest fossil fuels, it's much broader.
What I'm visualizing, though, is it gets into national news. That's what I'm visualizing, because if you're going to stir the pot, let's stir the pot.
You're preaching to the choir. I'm with you, but that's the difficulty we have, is it's the churches, the only experience I've really seen in my experience has been when I went to South Africa in 96 and saw how church leaders were actually looked to for the kind of thing that you're talking about. Tutu is the one we know about, but other church leaders, and they were interesting enough, they were influenced by Bonhoeffer there, many of the church leaders. That's why we ended up with a Congress down, you know, 2 years after Mandela came to power. But I even noticed it just when we were there, how the church leaders were viewed by the political leaders.
Like the moral compass of the country.
Yeah, it was much more apparent there than I'm seeing here. I would like to see what you're talking about happen. I hope that I don't see it happening in that way. But I don't want to be too cynical here either, because we need to that voice is going to need to be heard. It's interesting. One thing I can say, there are scientists, like E.O. Wilson is one of them, who are really appealing to faith leaders to step up on this issue, because they have the expertise, but they're recognizing that that motivational question, faith leaders can be helpful in dealing with that that particular issue. And doing what I think E.O. Wilson, some of these scientists are really calling for what you're talking about. So it's good to hear, though, there'll be a memorial also from Minnesota and Oregon coming to the... So those kinds of things, they may not be enough, but it can be a point to get things rolling.
And the Pope is always good.
And the Pope, you know, the Pope is the one, this Pope is being listened to in some ways that gives some hope of heading in that direction. All right, let's see. I'm conscious of the time. I think, if you don't mind, we'll just go a little longer, because we can, but I think we can finish up fairly early, Christy. I think we can actually talk about ecological crimes against the natural world. Again, that's Pope Bartholomew talks about that in some of his writings, and also a particular concern about the in terms of human beings, that the poor and the marginalized often pay the heaviest, most often pay the heaviest price for some of our ecological sins. And there's a concern lifted up about environmental racism. So just a tendency, for example, to a dump or an incinerator may be located in a neighborhood where amongst the poor who have less voice and able to influence
You when you work for our company, you might risk your health, but on the other hand, you should just be happy to have a job. Yeah.
That was the mining view up until regulation put OSHA and some other preventive measures. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the mines were a colossal illustration of that.
And a lot of our chemicals, which we banned in the U.S., then they exported to South America.
Yeah.
And there are several banned in Europe that we still accept. Yeah.
So that's the kind of thing that this is getting at. The classic phrase is the shorthand is NIMBY. Or
not in my backyard.
Not in my backyard.
Won't hurt me, I'll let it go.
Wangari Maathai likes to name places where we see heaven and hell on earth. She's very concrete, so that's her, part of her strategy is to just look at it. Where do we see heaven? Where do we see hell on earth? Where you come to Holden Village and you have kind of heaven and hell, and they're trying to work on the hell and minimize it somewhat, you know, in terms of the what happened with the mining. But that is ongoing challenge. And this issue of environmental racism continues to get lifted up. Interesting enough, James Cone, who's very much been a voice talking about social justice and racial justice, he talks to both communities, to the white community, saying you can, if you're concerned, environmentalists and particularly, so you can be concerned about that, but don't forget the poor and the marginalized. But then to the African American community, he says, we can't ignore environmental issues because the impact is so wide that we simply can't ignore that. Then to this metanoia, the concept of conversion or repentance, and so this call to ecological conversion. And here I'm hoping I'm responding to your question, Eric, as you go through this. Maranatha experience, that simply refers to church in Portland back when I was in high school. We went, our high school youth group went there. Our two leaders were young adults in their early 20s, and they wanted to take us to Maranatha. And this was early 70s. The Jesus movement was very prominent out here in Oregon in the Northwest. And so Maranatha was the place you'd gather on Sunday night. So we went there, and let's just say I was at a point in my life where I wasn't necessarily in just praising the Lord all the time. And I once counted the head guy up front, and I was a pastor's kid, so this is kind of thing a pastor's kid would do. I counted how many times he said, praise the Lord, in 2 minutes, and it was 32 times. And what I'm getting at here is the focus was on your personal relationship with Jesus. Now, I think a personal relationship with Jesus is utterly crucial, but the way you did it there, again, it was very individualistically focused. And that was an experience I had early on. So when we talk about, I call it radical concept of conversion, talking about a turning away from an excessive focus on self or even on one's own kind, human beings, and a turning toward God, other human beings, and the whole creation. Right? So that's, so again, the creation comes in here along with other human beings and of course, the turning to God. So I want to lift up the importance of daily personal intimacy with Jesus. That's a very important part of our tradition and our faith as followers of Jesus, but also daily personal intimacy with creation. And it strikes me again that Holden is very intentional about cultivating both of those. The personal relationship with Jesus, very much a part of the worship life here and the spirituality of Holden, but also a personal, daily personal relationship with creation and created world. So we arrive at a quadrilateral of core values of faith: love of God, love of neighbor, love of creation, and love of self. And in terms of ethical reality then, you know, our theology is grounded in God's love for us, as we say, revealed to us in Jesus, also experienced through the creation. But the ethical reality then is that followers of Jesus will live by these core values. That's what following Jesus is about. And these core values compel us then to engage in major ecological conversion. And so the church's primary vocation then, in my mind, we don't want to lose sight of this, the church as church, primary vocation is to preach and teach for conversion to God, other human beings, and creation. And that is to preach and teach love for God, other human beings, and creation. And now, the church can also be involved in other things, but there's a sense in which our human vocation is to engage in all of who we are, to care for God, other human beings, and creation. But this is what the church needs to focus on, and not lose sight of that in the midst of all the various things we get involved doing as a church. Here, there's an appeal for ecological humility here. We need to accept our limits as human beings. A certain element of hubris in our overconfidence in the human mind. And I'm not, yes, we should use our minds to the fullness, but I think we've had an excessive confidence in the human mind, an inordinate trust in the power of technology. And the measure of technology, finally, is people of faith, we say, does this technology lead toward shalom or not? Does it lead to the flourishing of life or not? So technology, and not, the danger, I think, is putting so much confidence in technology that, oh, we've got a big problem here. Well, we'll just figure it out. There'll be a new technology that will solve this for us. There may be, but at the same time, I think we need to look at very basic things like living within our limits conservation, for example, is not a bad idea, you know, in terms of actually addressing these things and not always put the confidence in technology.
But you think our assumption also goes that somehow the marketplace will figure it out.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
You know, because if you can make a buck off of it, then someone's going to do it. Yeah. So if they need, you know, if we need it, then they're going to make a buck and then they'll do it.
So I would say, good point. So in terms of the marketplace then, the same test for the marketplace. Does it actually lead us toward shalom and sustainability and that kind of sustainable way of life, or does it not? And as I think I mentioned the other day, James Hansen's willing to consider a tax, and what he wants to do is put a carbon tax, and then the proceeds, kind of like Alaska does in a way, with the pipeline, yeah, they get a certain amount back if there are the proceeds to do it. But you tax and you give it back to the people. And Hansen says, this is something that he wants to get both Republicans and Democrats on board, and so he said, we'll give the money back to the people, but the tax will increase, and that will help inhibit carbon emissions. He obviously hasn't won the day on this yet, but that's Hansen's idea. Because he's conscious, you know, the Republicans are not going to pass some carbon tax and then just have the Democrats decide what they want to do with the money for whatever the next Democratic project is. So he's trying to be realistic about that, but so far that hasn't won the day. I want to lift up this notion we need to engage in honest conversation and dialogue about these things as best we can. And so this is a call, conversion is also called honest dialogue and conversation about these things. I am concerned that there's a danger of hitting the wall. We may just keep going. I'm not a 400 runner, but I've heard about 400 runners, and they'll go in those first 300, and then when they come into the final turn, they hit the wall. And I somehow that image just triggers me that we may just hit the wall and just not, it, then things will come to a halt.
And if you're a good 400 runner, you don't hit the wall at the 300.
Because you pace yourself. And I think the pace of our life is out of whack. It's basically another way of understanding this. It's not a sustainable pace of life. And tomorrow, when I present tomorrow, I'll actually talk about the way we approach time is one of the difficulties here. And that was I never thought I'd be talking about time per se when we went into this project. And it became very aware that that's part of what we face. So, final point, we cannot violate our God-given limits with impunity. And isn't that what even Adam and Eve in that creation story have a difficulty of accepting the limits that God has given us and living within those limits? And the belief is, as human beings, if we focus on being human beings, living within our God-given limits, that's when life as human beings can flourish, and presumably, hopefully, all of creation can flourish. All right, time's up. How about 5 minutes here, and then we'll be, any comments or questions in addition? Been making some as we go along.
One thought I had while you were talking is, how provocative it is to think of the Good Samaritan parable in ecological terms. Huh. And then we started talking about Pope Francis and his encyclical, which made me think of Saint Francis and his personification of creatures and of the earth.
Yeah.
And so then it makes for actually a pretty accessible neighbor if you're thinking of the animals as brothers and sisters, and and the earth and the moon and the stars as brothers and sisters. And so there's kind of this extension of kinship.
Yeah.
So that was really, I just appreciate that. It was really provocative to take that parable. And it really is, I guess, an example to me of an imaginative ecological lens for reading scripture.
Huh.
So just an appreciative comment about that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That's kind of a Native American, you know, concept.
Yeah, very much.
I do, in the book, do draw on some Native American people who've written on this and on kinship and the notion of kinship. In fact, we have somebody that lives very close to us, just outside of Newburgh, called Randy Woodley, and he's done a lot of writing on kinship, and also on an understanding of time and the differences in some of the traditions on that. Others? All right. Well, glad to hear that we made it through the crisis. Unfortunately, the ecological crisis isn't quite
as made it through
simple.
That yet.
So tomorrow, for those who are interested, I'll finish off tomorrow at 8:30 to 9:30 is the final session. So thanks for coming.